Let's record this
bloody podcast.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, YouTube, Life or Death, Deezer and J-pop. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. On the other side of this table is Chris Cook, the business editor of CMU. We're going to talk for a while.
But not for an hour and 10 minutes this week.
No, we're going to really rein it in this week. Talking about the music industry.
But 47 minutes
we're
really
like,
for
we
this
never
week.
Really say up front what we're here for.
We're arrogant in assuming that anyone listening to this podcast will automatically know what it is that we're doing.
I think you're supposed to say up front, like, you're supposed to state your aims.
Is that...
For the next hour...
We just said 47 minutes.
For the next 47 minutes, we're going to talk about the music industry and what has happened in the last 7 days since we last recorded one of these podcasts.
Remit declared. Well done.
Yeah. Okay, good. Now we've got the professionalism out of the way. It can all fall apart from here.
Good.
And it will.
Are you having a good week?
Am I having a good week? Yeah. I mean, various disasters aside, I mean, I bought a heater that doesn't work, so that was a bit rubbish. I've broken another pair of headphones.
I'm having a good week, mainly for soup-based reasons.
Yeah, we don't need to go into
which
that.
Which
we
don't need to go into. Also, of
you
course...
You can read about that in the CMU Daily.
For some reason.
which has become quite soup-based this week.
David Bowie didn't die this week,
no.
So this week's better than last week.
I suppose, yeah.
In that respect. Some pop stars did die this week, but none of them important enough to merit a mention on this edition of the CMU podcast.
Wow.
Unlike Bowie last week,
harsh,
who had a whole
words.
10 minutes. It's a bit of an insult to Glenn Frey of Eagles.
Yes.
Who obviously is a very important musician and songwriter. But the podcast content committee decided that that was not something we're going to talk about.
Yeah, we don't make these decisions.
I'm not on that committee, so nothing to do with me. I personally think that's a bit insulting. But no dead pop stars on this edition of the podcast. It's all about... What is it all about?
Well, I stated what it's all about in the intro previous.
I think you said YouTube was on the agenda.
YouTube is on the agenda.
YouTube made it through the podcast
as
content
it so
committee
often is
selection process.
YouTube was on the agenda for most of 2015, but this week it's on the agenda because PRS has renewed its deal with YouTube.
Now, this actually happened while we were recording the last edition
it did.
Of the CMU podcast. So this is the oldest piece of news that you will find on this edition.
So we need to get it out of the way.
Of the CMU podcast. So just to quickly recap, the music industry has what I think would best be described as a love-hate relationship with YouTube. And I still remember, I talk about this weirdly frequently. I think I've been having a lot of conversations about YouTube recently, partly because I'm chairing an event for Music 4.5 next week on YouTube. I'm also currently putting together an entire day of content about YouTube for CMU Insights of the Great Escape in May. So I've been having a lot of YouTube conversations recently.
That said, we have been having a lot of YouTube conversations for a long time now.
And the thing I always reminisce about is almost exactly 2 years ago, MIDEM, the Music Business Conference in Cannes, which was still in January at that point, or maybe early February, there was that huge swing within the 3 days of MIDEM, because YouTube had always been the one bit of Google that the music industry didn't hate.
Yeah.
Because the music industry doesn't like Google search, because Google search continues to refuse to stop Pirate Bay links and kick-ass torrent links from appearing in their search results. And music companies and film companies and TV companies keep saying to Google, we all know the Pirate Bay is copyright infringement, we all know kick-ass torrents are copyright. Just to stop them from appearing in Google search. And Google won't do that. So they've always had problems with that bit of Google. But it used to be that with YouTube, generally, they liked YouTube. And then 2 years ago at MIDEM, suddenly YouTube was the enemy, to the point that people don't even talk about piracy anymore. People don't talk about the Pirate Bay or kick-ass torrents at these events anymore. YouTube is the enemy. And there was a couple of people from YouTube speaking at that event. I don't think anyone from YouTube has spoken at a music business event since.
They didn't have the nicest of times.
And so YouTube became an enemy of the music industry. And a year ago, that got reinvented into safe harbours, because YouTube exploits these things called safe harbours that exist in copyright law in both America and here in Europe. I'm not sure they're called safe harbours in Europe, but the principle is the same. So those exceptions in copyright law that basically say that technology companies cannot be held responsible if they provide the tools through which other people distribute content without licence, so in essence infringe copyright, providing they have certain systems in place that a rights owner can come along and say, oi, that's my content, that person person doesn't have permission to distribute it, take it down. So server companies can use these safe harbours, ISPs can use these safe harbours, but so does YouTube.
Yes. And that's where, I guess, the complicated relationship comes in. Because as you mentioned, like when we used to talk about piracy at music industry events, everyone would stand up and go, well, that's clearly bad. It's a terrible thing. People are using our music and not paying for it. Awful. And then some people, possibly less so at events, but people in the conversation would say, but this music being available for free actually promotes music, and people who download a lot of music actually go out and buy music. So they were arguing that there's this marketing benefit to file sharing services. However, in the case of YouTube, there's a marketing benefit in that the music industry uses it as a really big, important marketing tool. There's no grey area about it. It's happening.
You're right. So whereas previously when people would say, and I suppose you're actually going back as far as LimeWire and Kazaa, and people were saying, oh, well, actually, they're a useful promotional tool. But actually, most of the record labels would say, Arctic Monkeys would have disagreed back in the day. But the labels would say, well, we don't think it's a marketing tool. Whereas they can't say that about YouTube, because you're right. If you're in the marketing team of a record company, you spend half your life...
They have people whose job it is to market on YouTube.
YouTube is an incredibly important marketing channel. And it is a revenue-earning marketing channel. So unlike the piracy sites, you can earn money off YouTube because they will share the ad revenue with you, and you can put advertising pre-rolls and banners and all that stuff around your content. So YouTube has lots of good stuff about it. It is a great marketing channel. It is a revenue generator. It's one of the few ad-funded platforms that is bringing in all right money into the music industry. Certainly the music industry at large is getting decent ad income from YouTube. But nevertheless... as of 2 years ago, the record companies decided that YouTube is not a friend, it's an enemy. We're still doing all the marketing and we're still taking our share of the ad revenue, but we don't like them. Basically because we don't think YouTube is paying us enough money. And I suppose by that point, Spotify was really starting to take off. Deezer was sort of following behind. And the income coming in from subscription streaming services, audio streaming services, were starting to rise. And at that point, the labels were saying, well, we thought that the ad money we were getting from YouTube was good, but now we see the money we're getting from Spotify and Deezer. Actually, this isn't that good money. Plus, the audio streaming services like Spotify are telling us that the fact that YouTube exists is making it harder for them to sign up freemium subscribers, let alone premium subscribers, especially amongst a younger audience.
Yes.
And so the labels have started to say to YouTube, we need more money. YouTube say, we haven't got any more money. And I think the reason why Safe Harbours comes into it is the labels feel that their negotiating hand is weakened to a point in that if they were to stand up to YouTube and say, you're not paying us enough money, we're pulling all of our content out, YouTube could turn around and say, well, good luck with that.
Yeah.
Because we all know people all over the world are uploading your content. And okay, Content ID or system is there to help you manage that, but it still requires time, it requires resource. And if you're not doing a deal with us, you have to do that at your expense. There's no kickback in that. So this is why YouTube has been a big issue for the last 2 years, safe harbours for the last year. But the industry continues to work with YouTube, including PRS.
Yes, so PRS announced this deal. Went, hey, we've renewed our deal. It's really good that we've done that. Everyone's happy. There's no problem. It was a very positive press release. I mean, press releases tend to be positive, don't they? But with regard to everything, this whole debate going on around YouTube at the moment, it was a particularly kind of noticeably positive press release.
And I suppose PRS are very much part of this debate. PRS have been critical, maybe not about YouTube by name, but they have certainly been a big participant in the safe harbours, they're evil. Well, they don't use the word evil, obviously.
No, you use it.
I use the word evil. Safe harbours need to be reformed, very much pursuing that agenda, lobbying on that agenda alongside the record companies, and of course the SoundCloud litigation, which we know has been settled, because I think we mentioned that on last week's podcast. But
it happened.
The SoundCloud litigation, when PRS sued SoundCloud, that was all about safe harbours and testing exactly what the safe harbour laws in Europe say. So PRS have been very vocal on this issue, yet at the same time, and I suppose on one level it's like, well, that's a bit hypocritical. But then I suppose on another level it's like, well, that's sort of admirable that you can have some fundamental issues over here, but at the same time you recognise that there's business to be done over here. And it would be insane... well, this is me basically calling the German version of PRS insane, because Gamer has said, we're just not going to work with YouTube. I actually think PRS are to be admired. Is admired? Perhaps I'm stressing that too much. It's a good thing that PRS are able to admit they have issues with certain things over here and to try and address those issues, but at the same time, not say, but we're not going to do any business with you and therefore all that ad money you could make us were going to kick away.
Yeah, so as I said, they were very, very positive about it. PRS boss Robert Ashcroft said that the deal drives improved value across the PRS and MCPS membership. That's positive.
It is.
Upbeat.
As we said, with the original YouTube PRS deal, which was done a number of years ago, I've never met a songwriter or a publisher, the beneficiaries of that deal, who understood how the deal worked. So we'll have to take Robert Ashcroft's word for it that this deal is not only the value they got before, but they get more value from this deal too, because still people don't really understand how it works. But hey, it's a good deal.
It's a good deal. We know, we do at least know, we might not know how it works, but at least we know it covers any PRS repertoire that isn't subject to the direct deals done by the big five publishers.
Correct.
So most of it. and mechanical rights covered by MCPS and Impel.
Yeah.
So that's another chunk of stuff. And perhaps most importantly at this juncture, it covers YouTube Red, which is YouTube's subscription service yet to launch in the UK, but coming this year.
Yeah, so already live.
So it's a deal that YouTube needed.
Yeah, so it's live in the US. We suspect that the second market we'll launch in is here in the UK. So that's YouTube, £10 a month, get rid of the ads, get some extra premium content. And I suppose from a rights owner's point of view, I don't know how it works on the publishing side, if I'm being honest, but certainly from a recorded content point of view, it's quite an important difference, because rather than having a share in ad revenue, you have a share in that subscription revenue. But it means that the royalties are shared out in the sort of complicated way that Spotify works, whereas with a YouTube channel, it's quite straightforward. If there's ad content on my channel, I get 55% of that revenue, whereas with subscriptions, it's more complicated. But that is definitely a sign that YouTube is busy getting the paperwork done to get YouTube Red Live in the UK and have all of the music content on board and ready to go. So YouTube is going to continue being a big talking point this year, which is just well, because we've got all day looking at it at The Great Escape. Although actually the Music 4.5 event I mentioned next week and the YouTube stream at The Great Escape will be less on licensing. We're not going to talk so much about that. We're going to talk about all of the other ways in which artists can and possibly should be using YouTube to drive engagement and income and revenue, and also looking at how the YouTubers, whether they're musical or not, are using YouTube to build a business and whether the stuff that the music industry can learn from that. So lots of YouTube conversations will continue over the next 12 months, which means I will continue to tell my Medem 2 years ago anecdote on a regular basis. So that's one of my favourite anecdotes. So I'm glad that the opportunity will be there.
Well, lucky you.
To continue.
Really, you've come out best from this situation.
I have indeed. So well done, PRS, with your YouTube deal.
So on to a story that, I mean, will seem to blow up very quickly this week, resulting in the space of about 24 hours of first a CEO resigning and then basically an entire company shutting down. But actually, the story stretches back several years, it emerges. It started with Amber Kaufman from the Dirty Projectors tweeted about, well, she only referred to a very popular music publicist. Basically, she said, rubbed my ass and bit my hair in a bar. And this is some guy she'd only just met. And she was very shocked about it and hadn't talked about it before. But then she'd been talking about it a couple of years later and it had really made her angry again. She referred to it without naming anyone on Twitter. And then a few hours later, named the person in the story as Heathcliff Berry from Life or Death PR, a US PR company.
And it was interesting that she was, as you say, referring to an event that happened a couple of years ago. And I've only read the tweets in the same way everyone else has. But you really felt that it wasn't that she was setting out to launch a campaign against this individual or this company. She was literally saying, oh, I've just been reminded of this incident that happened. It was a horrible incident. And talking about, and totally understandably, how with hindsight, she was like, why did I not confront this guy at the time? But that is the way these horrible incidents occur. And as you say, subsequently, she named names. But I don't think she was setting out to start some sort of conflict with the man or his company.
No, and I think that's shown, there's like a 3-hour gap between her telling the story and then naming it, which suggests that she didn't set out to do this.
But it was quite remarkable almost that the impact that had, I mean, there were other reasons why this impact occurred, which we can mention, but the fact that, I mean, I suppose in terms of the allegations that have been made against this guy, we can't really comment on those, except that he hasn't denied them. And he sort of issued a statement relatively
quickly.
He sort
of half admitted them, half... Well, I know his statement's slightly odd, but anyway, we'll come to that.
But my point is the fact that this was quite a dramatic turn of events for him and for his company, relating initially to an event that was 2 years ago. So it's not like there was some horrible incident last week and then it all kicked off and then he had to resign and then it had an impact on the company. It was somebody reminiscing about a horrible event that happened a couple of years ago and then it had this big impact. But so the reason it had this big impact is that it very quickly became apparent through the social networks that this was not a standalone incident involving this guy.
No, because once one person had the courage to step forward and name names, actually a lot of other people started saying, this happened to me, and for various reasons I'd never had the courage to come forward and say this. In one case, she was allegedly assaulted by this guy and told her manager, and her manager basically said, well, you're going to have to get over that sort of thing if you want to have a career in music. And so people feel like they're told, don't mention this, don't rock the boat. But then once one person's named a name, people kind of, like I say, people started coming forward. Lots of people had stories about this guy.
Yeah, so the inappropriate behaviour with the women that he was working with, both artists that he was representing through his agency, also some people who'd worked behind the scenes. So Amanda Kaufman came forward and told this story and gave the information. All of these other things came forward. And it all spiralled really fast. And I mean, on one level, that's not surprising, given the allegations that were being made. And some of them were more serious than others, but all of them were utterly unacceptable. I suppose it should be mentioned that Amber Kaufman did say that she told her label, Domino, about this at the time, and Domino have never worked with Life and Death PR again. And although Domino didn't go into any detail about that when they were asked for comment, they did confirm that what Amber had said was correct. But these different stories went out there. But it was within 24 hours. Indeed, I think all of this sort of happened overnight, a lot of it to us here in the UK, because it was an American PR agency. And almost as soon as those stories started to circulate, Heathcliff Beru himself had issued a statement basically saying that he was standing down as CEO. As you say, he was a little bit ambiguous about the allegations made against him, although he did not explicitly deny any of it. And he talked about his own problems with drug and alcohol addiction, and in essence was saying that that was the cause of these unacceptable incidents, and that he was resigning forthwith as CEO of his agency. He was going to check himself into rehab to try and overcome his own demons, and that somebody else in the company would be stepping forward and running the agency forthwith. And so within 24 hours from the first story being told and then these other allegations being made, that statement was out there, and he personally was no longer anything to do with this agency that has been around for a significant period of time and worked with a lot of artists and a lot of labels over the years.
Yeah, and while this is all going on, like various bands that the company works with had already kind of started tweeting, we're not working with this company
current
anymore.
Current clients,
yeah, had said, we don't want to be associated with this company. So even though Heathcliff Beru stepped down, it's already kind of turned the name Life or Death PR, even though the other people in the company are not accused of anything, it's sort of turned the name toxic very quickly from from being a very popular PR company to not overnight, like you said. And so the next stage in the story was that they announced that basically, they didn't announce it as the company shutting down, they announced it as the staff of Hall left.
Everybody.
And they go, so it was a small staff. Yeah, and they're all now going to set up a new company with a different name, completely dissociating themselves from their former CEO, which I don't know if that is partly to keep their clients who are threatening to leave or have left. Killer Mike put out he tweeted that he was happily to stand by his day-to-day publicist. He considered Heathcliff Beru a friend and he supported the women who'd all come forward and said that it was important that they were given the platform to make allegations like this, but also said he supported someone he considered a friend in attempting to, become a better human being.
Yeah, so Killer Mike uses the services of Life or Death PR, but actually his day-to-day contact there isn't this Heathcliff guy. It's a different publicist within the agency, and he was saying, he's a great publicist, he's a great guy, I'm going to continue working with him, which presumably suggests that he's going to move his business to the new agency that they're going to set up. And actually, it was Killer Mike's statement that first told us that despite the fact that the original statement from the agency was that the CEO was resigning and that the company would continue under new management, it was him who said Life or Death PR is no more.
Yes.
And the confirmation of that followed. And it was interesting, I suppose, because a lot of this was happening overnight our time, because it was in America. When we wrote about the first stage of this story, which was Amber Kaufman's statement and Heathcliff Beru's response to that. But as you were writing that story, you did say, hang on a second, their website's down and their social seems to have been turned off. It looks like actually they're going to wind the company up. And then 24 hours later, when we got up to write the next stage of this story, that is indeed what had happened. And lots of people rightly have commended Amber for sharing the story, even though, as I say, it doesn't seem like she set out with any particular mission. But to have the honesty to sort of step forward and talk about this in a very honest way, lots of people have commended that and actually think that the outcome of all of this is a good outcome. But it all slots into an increasing number of blog posts and articles. And I think you pointed out, actually, it's the various Vice websites who have run most of these articles about the continued misogyny that exists in parts of the music industry. And this is something we talked about at The Great Escape a couple of years ago, didn't we? When we talked about, first of all, misogyny in the output of the pop industry, but then also the sexism that exists within certain parts of the music industry and within certain music companies and the problems that that causes. And what can we do? How is it that in a liberal, forward-looking, progressive industry, how is it in 2016 that this is still an issue? But it is still an issue. And what can we do? Although there are a lot of opinions that have been expressed this week is, well, one of the things we can do is when these incidents like this occur, when you've got guys like this acting utterly inappropriate, is that we do call people out. And if your manager says, oh, you're just going to have to tolerate that, I mean, if you're a buzzy new band desperately trying to do deals in the industry, I can understand why you wouldn't. But is saying, no, that is not acceptable because it isn't acceptable. But
I think I suppose what that shows is actually there is a lot of support for people coming forward with stories and naming names. And I think people who are, you know, have these stories would have felt very differently if Amber Kaufman had come forward, named names, and then the guy had carried on as normal, nothing. But actually, like I say, the story escalated very quickly from someone tweeting something to a company shutting down. And I think that could have a positive effect in convincing people that actually it's okay to come forward with these stories. You don't have to worry about your career being destroyed because you call people out on stuff. It's because the reason it perpetuates is because people get away with it.
And also, I think more established artists referencing things that happened 2, 3, 4, 5, however many years ago, when they were at a point in their career where perhaps they wouldn't have felt comfortable going public for career reasons, even though that's insane but totally understandable if that is the way the industry is. Whereas I suppose people at their point in their career now where actually they don't have to deal with that crap and they can stand up is a good thing, even if it means we're sort of referring to things that happened 2, 3 years ago, because there will be other people at the start of their careers who are also being put in these horrible circumstances who perhaps don't feel they can speak out for those career reasons. So it's good for people who are slightly more established to take the brave step forward, call these people out, and then the industry should respond, as it did in this case, by putting things right. And I think that is a way of us trying to overcome these problems. But, I mean, there needs to be a lot more conversation about this. What is clearly still a big issue for obviously society at large to address, but this industry to address as well. And as I say, this is a topic that we addressed at The Great Escape a couple of years ago. And this year at The Great Escape, we're going to be looking at diversity in the music industry, both gender diversity, ethnic diversity, and so on. And actually, that does stem into this to an extent, in that I think possibly one of the reasons why there are certain strands of the music industry where gender diversity is very poor, where there are other strands of the music industry where actually the male-female balance is pretty much 50-50, is probably because of the corporate culture of those other strands of the industry. And that is A, wrong, but also it's one of the reasons why we have such poor gender diversity in those strands of the industry. So we have to address this, A, because we have to address it, but B, also, another result of that is hopefully we start to see a bit more of a diverse workforce in those parts of the industries which are still ridiculously male-dominated. Time now for the CMU-approved bit of the podcast where Andy approves things. It's quite straightforward. Talk us through the artists you've been approving this week in CMU Daily, starting with Ekka.
Ekka are, they have been a pop duo who have been tipped for some time now.
Two Rebeccas.
Two Rebeccas, hence that's where they got Ekka from. They released an EP in 2014, which people noticed. And so, as I said, that's why they've been hotly tipped. And they eventually signed with Sony's RCA late last year. They have just put out the video for their first single under that deal, Small Talk. which I guess, you know, you take as a sign of things to come. It's a fun, upbeat pop track. It's got a bit more depth to it than maybe you'd first think. It's, I think, the first bit of music from a group you very much need to watch in 2016.
So still worth checking out despite being part of the major label machine.
Yes, even though they're part of that whole thing.
Love Speak.
Love Speak are a band formed from, do we still say from the ashes of... That used to be the cliche, isn't it? Well, formed from the ashes of I Am A Jedi, which was, let's say, not the greatest band name ever. However, they were...
I liked that band name.
It was a very good band.
They were. We saw them at The Great Escape.
We saw them at The Great Escape.
A few years back. In that pub that isn't a pub anymore. I remember.
Yeah, great venue that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I Am A Jedi, no more.
Like the pub.
Like the pub, indeed. But Love Speak are more... Yeah. Anyway, Love Speak are a band who feature, I think, the two main guys from I Am A Jedi. They're a bit more laid back, funkier, maybe a bit more... I mean, I Am A Jedi were quite pop, but on the rock side of pop, maybe I think Love Speak are more on the pop side of pop. They've just released their first single, DNA. They're already hotly tipped in Norway, where they are from, but I think have something to offer people who aren't Norwegian. So keep an eye on them. Have a listen to DNA.
Yeah, especially if you're not Norwegian.
Especially, yes.
Einar Indra.
He's from Iceland, as ever, keeping it international.
But mainly Nordic.
But mainly Nordic. His sound seems to have been developed based on a catastrophic hard drive failure, if his biography is anything to go by. He spent a few years making music, honing his sound, and then he didn't back it up. His hard drive broke, and he lost all of his music.
So he had to start all over again.
Although it says basically he was so put off by this experience that he just went totally acoustic for a while and then kind of eventually went back to making electronic music. And now, so what he's making now is sort of influenced by both electronic and the time he spent making acoustic music. So this track, his new single, Sometimes I'm Wrong, is sort of, it's based on a very kind of skeletal piano piece, but then layered up with electronic sounds and kind of messed around with. It's sort of, I mean, there's a bit of sort of James Blakeyness to it. I think there's a fragility to it, but his production technique is actually quite, not harsh, but he doesn't kind of pull any punches with messing about with stuff as he layers it up. It has a kind of actually quite bold sound that is, I guess there's a little bit of a juxtaposition there, but yeah, it makes it a pleasant listen.
And he's uploaded it to SoundCloud.
Yeah, yes.
So it's backed up.
Yeah.
Providing SoundCloud don't go out of business, and they raised a load more money, albeit they borrowed a load more money, basically. We talked about that last week, didn't we?
Yeah.
SoundCloud have got more cash, so fingers crossed they're around for a while. So at the very least, he's got his music backed up while SoundCloud are still in business. A Nighthawk are the final of this week's approvees.
Yeah, they're a duo. They are Ted Malmros from the Shout Out Louds. They're a good band. And Sarah Snavely, formerly of Dag for Dag. Well, that's not how you pronounce it, I'm sure. They're Swedish, anyway.
More
Chief
Nordics.
Nordic. They formed this duo in 2011. Since then, they've released two EPs. And they're about to release their debut album, which is called Ice in the Belly, Fire in the Mind, on the 26th of February. It's very dark, quite threatening pop, which you can hear in two tracks they've released so far this year, which you can hear if you go to the approved column where they are written about on the CMU website. As with all of these I just spoke about, go to completemusicupdate.com/approved and have a listen. Hey, you might have thought that Deezer was on the way out.
I never thought that.
What with announcing its IPO and then embarrassingly retracting it.
Yeah, that was a bit embarrassing.
That was quite embarrassing.
But
now it's raised 100 million euros in funding. So you kind of wonder why they bothered.
Well,
first, they were looking to raise, I think, 300 million in the IPO. So they're a bit down.
But even so.
But 100 million's all right.
So, of course, Deezer, the streaming service, in terms of numbers of users... Spotify has the most paying customers. Apple Music now comes second. Does Deezer come third or does Napster come third? It depends how you do the maths and whether or not you allow bundled mobile customers who have never actually used the service to count as paying subscribers or not.
Yeah.
But Deezer, often seen as the second streaming service behind Spotify, now the third behind Apple Music. They are in a very competitive marketplace. Spotify is ahead. Apple have all of the power that comes with being Apple. Deezer need to seriously grow their paying customer base. They're trying to rely less on their mobile deals, particularly in France, which is their home territory where they are most significant. So Deezer needs to grow. Growing in the streaming market needs money. They don't have the deep pockets of Apple. Obviously, nobody has the deep pockets of Apple. Spotify also has raised some finance relatively recently. So yeah, how is Deezer going to fund the next stage of their growth? The IPO was one way of doing it, although you could say it was weirdly early in their development as a business to be floating on a stock exchange. They were going to do it on the Paris Stock Exchange. That all then got abandoned. 100 million euro in the bank, mainly from existing investors.
Yeah, so Access Industries... I think the bulk of the money came from. That's the owner of Warner Music, of course.
So Access is an interesting company owned by Len Blavatnik. Has interest in lots of different businesses, Warner Music being its big entertainment play. But he has been investing in some interesting new startups. He's also an investor in Songkick on the ticketing side. Now a significant investor in Deezer. Orange, who were the original backers of Deezer back in the day in France, also putting some money in. But as you say, we suspect that a big chunk of that 100 million is coming from Access. In terms of how they're going to spend that money...
So they want to expand their user base, as we said. They also want to develop the product because that is... Well, it's interesting that the press release for this, these were saying, you know, they were talking up how big its catalogue is, which is sort of the old school way of pushing your streaming service. But they were saying they've got a 40 million track catalogue, which is bigger than any other streaming service.
Apparently.
Unless, of course, you count any of the ones that have bigger catalogues. But of the kind of the Deezer Spotify style ones, maybe that's the case. But that used to be the thing. You know, people always used to talk about how big their catalogue was. They don't really anymore, except Deezer's trying to bring it back. But
In the early days, because I suppose it was, we've got 10 million, or we've got 12 million, or we've got 20 million. But so once you get over, once you get over a few million, but certainly once you're over 30 million, what does that even mean? I can't picture the difference between 30 million tracks and 40 million tracks. I'm not going to choose my service based on those 10 million tracks. And that's before you even consider the stats out there that suggest that something like 70% of the tracks on Spotify have never been played, played once. So actually, it's of the extra 10 million tracks, how many of those are 10 million tracks that anyone will want to play? So you're right. Although that was what they were bigging up in this press release, because that's probably the main thing they've got at the moment, they do need to find some other ways to differentiate themselves from their competitors. And to be fair, they did say that that were as well as marketing and consumer acquisition, that was one of the things that they were going to invest some of this cash in.
Yeah, because diversification is the thing now. That's what they're all talking about. But actually, Deezer got in there quite quickly with buying Stitcher and pulling podcasts into its service. Although now that's Spotify's big plan as well now. So it's sort of the big problem with streaming services really is that they're all the same. And then once one announces something, they basically all do it.
Yeah, everyone copies. They all acquire something or do a partnership and they all add it on. But you're right, Pandora obviously has moved into the ticketing game through acquisition. Spotify has done some stuff in live. All the services continue to talk about their discovery tools and how they help you navigate their catalogue. And Discover Weekly, actually, Spotify's big innovation last year, seems to have been quite successful when it comes to the
discovery
elements.
Of all the kind of complicated discovery tools that we get thrown at us, Discover Weekly is kind of deceptively simple. I think what's happening behind it is quite complicated, but actually a playlist that just updates once a week with a load of tracks it thinks you'll like, it's very easy to get your head round compared to the things that they're usually trying to get you to engage with.
And of course, also this week, as Deezer confirmed, it now had all this money and some grand plans. Spotify suggested they have even more diversification plans and a little plot to add some extra plugins and products within the Spotify experience with a couple of acquisitions.
Two of them.
Two acquisitions.
And that's at the same time. They bought Chord Project, which is an American company, and Soundwave, which is an Irish company.
So tell us what Chord do.
Chord basically have a number of, I think what they describe as one-touch messaging apps. So their main one is called Chord. It's a voice messaging app. You basically record short voice messages. You hold down a button on whatever device. It works across various things from some phones to smartwatches, etc. And you just hold down the thing, you record what you want to say, and then it sends to whoever you want to send it to. It's a simple idea, I guess. I don't know whether that's something people want, but
the acquisition sparked speculation, is that Spotify thinking that there's some sharing and social networking element that they can add to Spotify by using this technology. Or, as we have seen in the Asian markets, the messaging app platforms are bringing music and content in. Is it that they're seeing that they need to compete in that space at all? I mean, sometimes with these acquisitions, they buy it because it looks like fun and then they do nothing with it. So it might not really tell us what Spotify are planning at all.
Possibly.
But interesting purchase.
Yes, and it's interesting that actually both these companies that you bought are working in similar spaces. Soundwave is specifically a music messaging app. It basically, it logs everything you listen to on your phone, and then you can send those tracks to people. People can follow you. They can chat either in groups or private messages about the music you're listening to. You can do various things in terms of kind of pushing individual tracks. So there's a bit of, I guess there's a bit of Last FM in there. There's a bit of This Is My Jam in there, and that you can pick a single song to say, this is the song I'm listening to at the moment. There's the messaging element, which people are talking about.
So more discovery, basically.
So, I mean, yeah, it has a recommendation system as well, I think. So yeah, discovery and recommendation. So it sort of looks like that's an area of its software that Spotify really wants to build up.
So I think to conclude, what we learned this week is if you're a startup doing anything in the sort of messaging discovery space, you should go to Deezer with their 100 million of new money and say, yeah, you need to buy us in order to compete with what Spotify are doing over there, and you got all this cash, give me 10 million of your 100 million. I think that's the main lesson that we can take from this week in Deezer Spotify developments.
Yes, I think that's the one takeaway from this, is that Deezer have some money and you should be asking for it.
Or if you're a coffee chain, Spotify also extended its partnership with Starbucks this week, so perhaps Costa could go get some of that 100 million and do something inane. Anyway, that's this week in streaming.
Just quickly, time to look through a few of the stories we haven't got time to talk about this week, which I am thinking of renaming the bit where we vaguely mention what SFX is doing. Because SFX last week was going bankrupt, this week has new financing. So it's not out of business yet.
Yeah, SFX got some more money. We don't quite know where from. There's an SEC filing that we're still waiting to read. I have a suspicion it will be from one of Robert F.X. Silliman, the founder's business ventures. I'm not quite sure who else would be lending money to SFX. At some point, something significant is going to happen at SFX, and we will spend 10 minutes talking about it. So let's stop talking about it now.
Yes, the European Attorney General says that private copy compensation doesn't have to come from device levies.
This is something that's currently going through the European Courts of Justice. The courts themselves are yet to rule on this. Let's assume that they will at some point in a future week, and then we'll talk about it in more detail.
Sure, yeah. SBTV has launched a new news channel.
So SBTV, obviously a music platform, but seemingly moving more into Vice's territory. I suppose Vice started off as an everything platform and moved into music through Noisy and Thump. SBTV seemed to be doing it the other way around. So yeah, their new service will cover all sorts of news. A bit of music news, but politics and technology and celebrity and show business and sport is what you can expect.
Good, good. A Metallica tribute act in Canada last week received a cease and desist letter telling them to stop using the Metallica name and logo in promoting their act, which you can see would be a problem for a Metallica tribute act.
Yeah, the lawyer who filed this lengthy bit of litigation was seemingly representing the band Metallica.
Yes.
Although the band Metallica didn't seem to be aware of this.
No, they said that this, yeah, their attorney, a very overzealous attorney, they said, had acted without their knowledge. And they told the band to ignore the letter, although ignoring legal letters is not always that easy. So Metallica then licensed the band the use of their logo for a dollar and then said, don't worry, we'll pay the dollar.
So if that was to ever come up as a problem again, the tribute band could say, look, we're licensed to say we're a Metallica covers band. So a fun little story that fizzled out quite quickly, but still made it to Beef of the Week, even though there wasn't really a beef, but it was a fun story.
Another little beef in the ongoing world of David Bowie anecdotes. Coldplay had their anecdote this week.
Their moment in glory in the NME.
Yes, because this is the week that Coldplay were announced as NME's godlike geniuses. And they'll pick up a trophy for that at this year's NME Awards. But David Bowie wouldn't agree. Apparently that they once approached him to collaborate on a song, sent him the song, and his response was, well, it's not very good, is it? And refused to sing on it.
So there you go. NME's godlike geniuses telling an anecdote about a genuine godlike genius rather than Coldplay.
Yes. And to read all of those stories in full, go to the show notes for this episode of the podcast at completemusicupdate.com/podcast.
Now, at the start of this edition of the podcast, when you did that this week thing that you do.
This week?
You billed J-pop.
I did.
Which now means in these latter few minutes of the podcast, we are running out of time. According to your intro, we've now got to talk about every single thing that happened in J-pop this week.
Which is quite a lot.
But we're going to hone in on two, maybe three specific things of particular interest.
Yes.
So it's a slice of J-pop, but these are the big stories from the Japanese pop music industry this week.
Yeah, because it has been a busy week. Busy week and a half.
Mainly with J-pop bands falling out with their management companies. And I suppose you need to know that J-pop is a very interesting part of the music industry in that the management companies who usually put these groups together and build the brand are incredibly powerful and much more so than the record companies that the artists sign to. Whereas over here in the UK, labels are often very powerful with those manufactured pop acts. And there will be some management going on in the background, but the managers never have quite the power over the brand and the group that you see in the Japanese market.
Yeah, and this this story deals with the two biggest. So SMAP, who are the, I would say, probably most successful and definitely longest serving current Japanese boy band.
And I mean,
I keep returning to them as a boy band, although they're all in their 40s.
It's
now.
Like calling Take That a boy band, isn't it?
Yeah. And so SMAP have been going a lot longer than Take That.
And unlike Take That, have never stopped.
Yes.
Lots of boy bands come back 10, 20 years later, but they've been going non-stop since they formed. Formed in the 80s?
Late 80s, but then I think probably properly debuted publicly in the early 90s. They're mainly, or continue to be known, I think, because they've presented a weekly TV show since 1996.
So also TV stars as well as
pop stars. It's a very weird show. There's an episode, if you can find it, there's an episode where they meet Michael Jackson. It's just odd because the management don't tell them that Michael Jackson's coming on the show. They pretend there's a rehearsal. Then Michael Jackson turns up, basically ignores them and goes and looks at a big screen they've got at the back of the studio. And then they all talk about how amazing it was.
So SMAP multiplied by SMAP. Is that what it's called?
Or SMAP by SMAP, I think.
The little X is a by. Yeah. So anyway, why were they in the news this week?
They're in the news because four of them, reportedly, I should say, but four of them did threaten to leave management company Johnny & Associates, which is arguably the most powerful management company in Japan. It's got all the big boy bands, as well as SMAP. They've got Arashi, who we've written about before, with a story involving some trees, and Sexy Zone, also a very big Japanese boy band.
And I suppose that is why, when we heard that four-fifths of the group were quitting Johnny & Associates, and it was because Johnny & Associates had seemingly let go the actual manager who worked with the group.
Yeah, their direct manager, who's worked with them since they were formed. So, you know, they've been with them nearly 30 years. She's had some dispute with another Johnny & Associates exec, whether it's Johnny Kitagawa, the head exec, or not, I'm not sure. But anyway, she was basically forced to resign. So in protest, four out of the five members of the band said, right, well, we're going to go with her.
And that led to the speculation that the group would have to disband, the theory being that Johnny & Associates are so important and they control these other really important groups that if they went off and did it on their own, they would struggle to get the TV exposure and the brand partnerships because all of those other people would be really nervous about annoying Johnny & Associates.
The brand, I mean, they've so many brand partnerships. They're a very profitable band. So everyone would stand to lose out if they did disband. But Johnny's does have other, not equally big maybe, but very, very big groups on their roster.
And younger groups.
So, I mean, there's ongoing speculation about how long SMAP can continue. As they get into their 40s. So, you know, arguably, if they did split up, they've got to come to an end at some point. Management company's going to know this. They've got other bands in place ready to kind of take up their throne. And as we say, there's such a powerful company. If four members of this group tried to go it alone, I think that it would be very likely they'd find that no one would work with them because no one would want to piss off their former management company.
So this was big news in Japan this week. It made the Japanese parliament.
Because, Betty,
eyes were on this week's edition of SMAP by SMAP.
Yes, so this week they appeared on TV and they spent the first 5 minutes of the show issuing a very solemn statement where they apparently all looked really miserable. But said, we're not splitting up. Basically sort of implied that they'd apologised to Johnny Kitagawa. And
yeah, we've been very naughty this week.
Now it's all fine.
Because this one guy who never threatened to quit was the peacemaker.
Yeah.
And they were able to go to Johnny and say, we're really sorry that we suggested we were going to quit. And it's business as usual, is basically what they were saying. Although we still don't really know what was going on behind the scenes.
No, or what business as usual means. Because there was also a report that their 25th anniversary tour, which was supposed to be happening in November, had been cancelled.
So, maybe this story is not yet done. Although the official line is, there may have been a temporary wobble, but all is good in the world of SMAP. And therefore, this isn't going to result in some litigation, when our other big J-pop story this week was very much around a bit of litigation.
Yes, this is a really interesting story. When these management companies put together these pop groups, they put together a lot of them, and they sign them up very young to very stringent contracts.
And again, comparing that to what happens over here, even when you have a management company or a label who collaborate and set up a pop brand, once that pop brand has become the next big thing, usually they're very much, certainly when it comes to management, I mean, Spice Girls famously fired Simon Fuller, didn't they?
Yeah.
They subsequently went back to him. But they were able, once he had built the Spice Girls to be the big phenomenon they were, they then had the power to say, well, screw you, we're not going to work with you anymore. That couldn't happen in J-pop because of the contracts they signed on day one.
Yes, because the way it works basically is, like SMAP formed, they didn't publicly debut until a few years later, because what happens is you sign up these groups very young, basically put them through a rigorous training program of how to be pop stars, then they debut on TV. If the public don't like them, then that's it, bye. And if the public do like them, then you've got a career.
And some of the more recent groups have done that thing where they have way more members than they need and only 5 perform at any one time, which means that if they then fall out with one of those people, it's really easy to get rid of them. No one member can have the power to control the group.
Yeah, well, it's the AKB48 model where there's an A team who are voted by their fans up and down. It's a very complicated hierarchy.
But if
system.
The A team were to misbehave, there's a B team ready to take their place.
There's a lot more than just a B team. And there's various offshoot groups. We can't get into that now.
Anyway, tell us about this week's litigation, which focused on a very specific term that appears in a lot of these draconian contracts.
Yeah, there's basically these contracts, especially with girl groups, there's a no dating clause in these contracts, which is enforced very strictly. I mean, weirdly, in Japan, girl groups are really marketed to men. And so they basically say, like, you're not allowed to date anyone, you have to
appear to be available. And indeed, in an earlier case, testing one of these clauses, when a management company sued over it, the judge basically okayed that.
Yeah.
And said, well, of course you need this clause in the contract with this girl group, because if they're not seen to be available, then the male fans won't want to be fans anymore.
Exactly.
And so that is the culture that we are dealing with here in the J-pop industry.
Yes. But what's interestingly now, in another case where a management company has sued over someone breaking this clause in their contract, it's the same court that other ruling came from, or a different judge, but this judge said that actually these clauses are unconstitutional.
Basically breaching human rights.
Yes, because you can't tell someone they're not allowed to have relationships
for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to have like a SMAP-length career, that can't possibly work. I don't think SMAP don't have the no relationship clauses in their contracts. I'm not sure if they ever did. But what's interesting is that actually, I mean, this is obviously, it's a contentious point. It would be interesting to see if this sets a precedent and they now can't enforce these clauses, because it is like just weird. And
so interesting development on that front, and as you say, interesting in the context of this one legal dispute between one management company and one member of a former girl group. But does it set a precedent, and will we see other action being taken to try and remove these clauses, or at the very least to prevent management companies from enforcing them? I mentioned that there was a third story. I don't think there's time to talk about it, but it's a very interesting story, so do go check it out on the website. Technically a K-pop story.
Yes, although there are Japanese members of this K-pop group.
Indeed, there
are. And one Taiwanese member, which is where the story comes from.
Yeah, so it's a girl group called TWICE that was set up by a reality TV show in South Korea last year, and it all relates to a recent election in Taiwan, because the Taiwanese member of the group was seen, well, basically just seen flying the Taiwanese flag. But that then links into the pro-independence versus anti-independence political divide in the country of Taiwan. and a statement was issued. It's an interesting story that also is all linked into to the politics of that part of the world, and it's on the website, completemusicupdate.com. That was also, we've had a very J-pop, K-pop week.
We have.
In the old CMU Daily this week, but that was because there was a number of very interesting developments and controversies.
Yes, but as you say, that's all we have time for this week, so we best wrap this whole thing up. What is the most unreasonable clause in your contract? Why don't you tweet us at CMU and let us know? I'm not sure how that's going to work.
Well, I look forward to seeing the tweets and we'll see.
One of the clauses in your contract for listening to this podcast is that you review us on iTunes.
Although that's not an unreasonable clause.
It's not unreasonable. It's perfectly reasonable, but you do have to rate us 5 stars.
Which is possibly unreasonable.
Well, you could say that. But, well, it's done now. You signed up. You agreed by pressing play.
And we will sue you if you don't do it.
Yes. So please do that because as weird as it sounds, it does actually help because iTunes is the gatekeeper of all podcasts and getting more ratings helps get it to more people.
Yeah, so basically,
so please help us.
Aside from you being contractually obliged to do this, you'll also be kicking it to that evil Apple empire.
Yeah, but kicking it to Apple by helping us get more listeners.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly. Well, we're playing the system is the point. They've introduced this unreasonable system and we're playing that system. It all links in somehow. Just do that bit you do at the end of this podcast.
This podcast was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7Digital.
Right, but there's a bit of bass. God, I don't even know what I've said anymore.
Something about James Blake.